You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 22nd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, best-selling author Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Also on the program today, Ohio, the latest state to accept an expanded Medicaid. Some 300,000 people will now get health care. The one part of the Affordable Care Act, which is working without equivocation in those states that are allowing it to work. Sarah Palin may be on to something. That in and of itself should be its own news story. J.P. Morgan, boo-hoo. $13 billion, but of course, when you read the fine print, they're doing just fine, ladies and gentlemen. More evidence. Well, I got to say, Ann Coulter agrees with me on my theory of conservative ink. Yet, she simultaneously stabs irony in the heart and makes it crumple into the floor. We'll get to that report about Iraq. And Governor Paul LePage of Maine is at it again, folks. All right, we will get to this. What are you saying, Michael? What are you asking me?
You want me to, Max is running a few minutes behind. Can you do an opening story?
Oh, sure. Well, I will do a couple. You could have just said Max is running behind. Max apparently is late. Be that as it may, this story, and we'll talk about the implications of this man's decisions. There's a new book out by journalist Peter Baker on the decision-making process, or lack thereof, I think, involving the Iraq War. But in an interview with 60 Minutes, former Vice President Dick Cheney says he once feared that terrorists could use the electrical device that had been implanted near his heart to kill him and had his doctor disable its wireless function. Cheney says that he and his doctor, cardiologist Jonathan Reiner, turned off the device's wireless function in case a terrorist tried to send his heart a fatal shock. Years later, Cheney watched the scenario on the program Homeland. I was aware of the danger, if you will, that existed, but I found it credible. Because I know from experience we had and the necessity for adjusting my own device that it was an accurate portrayal of what was possible. Also, I continue to watch 24 and go through Fox and Friends binges. marathon sessions. I save it on my DVR. Cheney and his cardiologist, Reiner, are promoting a new book they call co-authored Heart, An American Medical Odyssey. Now, here is one thing that I think is a little bit chilling. In the 60 Minutes interview, Reiner says that he worried that Cheney could not withstand the pressure that came on September 11th, 2001. He says he watched the news coverage of the day's events on television and thought, oh, great, the vice president is going to die tonight from hyperkalemia. Now, contemplate this for a moment. Cheney's doctor, and one would imagine Cheney, also were aware that this guy had a limited or had significant fears that this guy had a limited capacity for stress. And yet he is serving as the vice president. Not even serving, he self-selected himself. You'll recall that he headed the search committee for George Bush's vice presidential search and came back with, George, it looks like I'm the best candidate. All right, sounds good to me. as long as we can keep partying. Forget this. This is what I like. Just like a two-minute conference on this. All right. Slam dunk, as they say.
Do you think the Bush was the one who came up with that threat perception about the heart? Like Bush woke up in the middle of the night after having a nightmare and like tore into Cheney's room to explain to him that his heart could get blown up.
You know, it's possible that maybe someone could remote control you, give you a heart attack. I was spending a whole night just sucking on pretzels thinking about this. Sucking on pretzels, winky winky. Asked on 60 Minutes if he worried about his physical health impacting his judgment and cognition, Cheney replies, no. He was aware of potential side effects from limited blood flow to the brain and effects on cognition and judgment, but he didn't worry about it. Why should I care? You understand that this guy knows that he has... This is the guy who developed the 1% doctrine. You recall that there may only be a 1% chance that we could be hit, but we should essentially blow up the entire world to prevent it. Yet he knows he has a substantial risk of really just coming up with crazy ass ideas because of limited blood flow to his brain. Or that he could die from any type of severe stress. I'm still the best choice. The guy is a sociopath. And incidentally, he came out today, said the Tea Party is great, which I think you could attribute to his daughter trying to run for Senate. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Max Blumenthal about his new book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program best-selling author Max Blumenthal here to discuss Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Welcome to the program, Max.
Great to be back with you.
Now, Max, I want to start this because, I have not discussed Israel terribly much in this version of my program. I used to talk about it quite a bit more back in the day. But let me, I want to read just from a brief piece that MJ Rosenberg wrote about your book, because I think in many respects, it sort of captures, my feeling about this book as well, and why it's so important. He writes, "Those who absolutely hate Israel will take the book in stride because they have no use for Israel anyway. But for those who care about Israel, who know the occupation is bad but may not know it is this bad, the book will be a shattering experience." He goes on to write, "In fact, the reason the American right is so insane here is because it feels correctly that we have lost our country. They have. Due to demographic trends, they won't get it back. Israel is the opposite. The right is triumphant in politics and culturally." And he goes on to say, "I had to read this book because without knowing the depth of the problem, there is no way to fix it, and I believe Israel is fixable." Before we get into the depth of the problem, Max, tell us why you set out to write this book. I mean, just, you know, give us the broad strokes of what this is a picture of.
Well, just as a journalist, I mean, you know what's going on, but everyone in your country is afraid to talk about it. And that's a huge opportunity as a young journalist like me, who I had just had a successful first book, and I had a decent book advance and some royalties because I actually made money off my first book. And so I just reinvested it in kind of a more ambitious project. And I had somehow gotten a book deal that was very open-ended, where I could tell the real story about what Israeli society was really going through and what Israel really is. This was back in 2009, when Israel had just elected the most right-wing government in its history, against the backdrop of the assault on the Gaza Strip, Operation Cast Lead, that killed 1,400 people in 3 weeks in this besieged, overcrowded, ghettoized territory of refugees that just shocked the world. So I just dropped into to Tel Aviv to see how this was affecting Israeli society, and really immersed myself in the key institutions of Israeli life to paint a picture of a society and a state that had gone over the edge, perhaps permanently, but where the seeds had always been there, the seeds of its own self-destruction. The toxins lay in a system that we are prevented from discussing because of a lot of political pressures, and it's just a system of ethnocracy that's always privileged one group over another group. And so my book not only, you know, is an ethnography where I introduce readers to all sorts of people across the political spectrum in Israel-Palestine, from young Palestinian citizens of Israel who are tech workers who are mysteriously being brought in for interrogations by the Shin Bet, to Israeli army refusers, to middle-aged, upper middle-class women who are counseling these young people on how to refuse the army and themselves are being interrogated, to Border Patrol officers. I slipped into a base in the West Bank posing as a human rights counselor and got to spend the day with some of the most, underprivileged people in Israeli society who basically been given the opportunity to earn their benefits by being put in one of the worst units of the Border Patrol and basically enforcing the control and domination of Palestinians, and talking about what their lives are like. So there's this ethnography, but then there's also an analysis of how it all fits together and what brings these people together. And it's really a system of ethnic separation and, you know, the domination and control of an indigenous group that's really almost unique in the world. Besides the fact that I find that abhorrent as someone who grew up as an American liberal Jew, I also find it really fascinating because it's this 19th century blood and soil ideology that's playing out under a really high-tech apparatus in the 21st century that much of the world is seeking to copy and emulate. So that's really what inspired my book and kind of how I approached how I approached it and why I think it's an almost unique book because of the way I was able to immerse myself, especially in Israeli society, but also over the Green Line, in what could have been a Palestinian state if there ever was going to be one, and to really try to communicate it back to Americans, and to speak, you know, with I think, quintessentially, liberal American voice about what I'm witnessing there.
All right. Well, let's start with some aspects of that ethnography. One of the things that I found really fascinating was the stories of how the education system is working. And you know, and I think in general, my sense is that there has been a real corner that has turned over the past 10, 12, 13 years or so. And I think, you know, you would argue that there was a certain inevitability to this. And let's get to that a little bit later. But let's talk about what you saw in the education system. I mean, there was a story that you told about a poster in a kindergarten class. Tell us about that, because I think that's really relevant, because we are inundated with this notion of how Palestinians are taught to hate Israelis, et cetera, et cetera. Talk about what you saw within the education system.
Yeah, I think it's remarkable because Palestinians are experiencing occupation on a daily level, but many young Israelis, especially in school, who haven't gone to the army yet, require actually much more indoctrination than what I saw in Palestinian society, because it's easy to indoctrinate kids when you're humiliating their father. But when you're not actually experiencing violence or war directly, you require this indoctrination, like what I write about in a school, and actually a preschool in a Tel Aviv suburb called Holon, where 4-year-old children were basically lined up before a poster which featured, it was basically a diagram, and it started with a question: who wants to kill us? And then it pointed to various groups that have supposedly killed Jews throughout history. I mean, the Nazis, of course, have killed Jews. Then there are the Persians, then the Egyptians from the Bible, and then the Arabs, the present-day contemporary Arabs, who are portrayed as the heirs to the Nazis. And then another line points to a question: what do we need? And then a line points to the answer: we need a state. So this is all how the idea of a Jewish state, an exclusively Jewish state, is rammed into the heads of these children. And they go through life with this level of indoctrination. A friend of mine told me that in her kindergarten, above the blackboard, was the phrase, which is a famous phrase in Israel, first declared by an early right-wing Zionist named Joseph Trumpeldor, although he may not have said it, but it said, "It's good to die for your country." This is what kindergartners were exposed to. Teachers under the last education, Gideon Sar, who was to the right of Netanyahu, were enrolled in a program called where they were declared lifelong draftees. In other words, it was their job to help prepare children for military service at all levels. And young women in the Israeli army are brought in as replacement teachers in kindergarten in uniform to help confer this cuddly image on the army. Going into high school, children begin in earnest pre-military preparation. And so at age 17, many Israeli children, especially middle class and upper middle class kids, and this is now, you know, there are now maybe hundreds of thousands who've gone on this trip, but they go on the March of the Living, where they send them to Auschwitz. Mm. And entering this program, studies show that the high schoolers are very skeptical about the army. They don't know what they're getting into. They see images on TV that disturb them of the occupation, of Palestinian homes being demolished. And they're skeptical, but then they go into this extreme process of indoctrination in what was former death camp for Jews that ends with them, and I write about this, being in a gas chamber where they take on the personas of young Jews who were slaughtered in the camp, and they much more nationalistic. All, you know, polls of their attitudes show they're more nationalistic coming out, and they have a much stronger, more positive opinion of the army. And many of them come to see the Palestinians as the heirs of the Nazis. Now, if we listen to Netanyahu, we see this reflected in his own attitudes. And, of course, he is an exploiter who is he's exploiting the lessons of the Holocaust to create political space for military attack on Iran and to perpetuate the occupation. But there's also something sincere about him, that he grew up in this environment. And he understands the world this way, especially from his generation. And so at his last major national security speech at Bar-Ilan University, which is the base of the religious nationalist movement in Israel, Netanyahu basically said, to hell with the peace process, to hell with two states. The reason the Palestinians hate us is an occupation. It's because they're anti-Semites. And he said, anti-Semitism is a poisonous tumor in Palestinian society. And then he went on to blame Palestinians for the final solution for the mass extermination of Jews in Europe. And he held them responsible directly for the slaughter of 4,000 Jewish children. So the indoctrination doesn't just come from the education system, although it starts there and it prepares people, but it also comes from the Israeli elected leadership. The fish stinks from the head.
Right.
And so it's a totalistic environment that makes it very hard for people who are dissidents, who have a progressive attitude, or who resist the official Zionist narrative to emerge. That's why real kind of leftist democratic forces in Israel are so marginalized right now.
Yeah, I mean, I want to get to that part of it, because there's a real sort of palpable sense that that's the case in terms of the real diminishment of a left, or maybe a shift from where the left was from years ago. But I want to stay on these points about that study where the kids are sent to Auschwitz, because the fascinating thing that you also write about is what happens to military vets who have served in the military, who have served in the occupation, and they go through that program. It is reversed in terms of what it does to them.
That's a great question. This is actually, as I was looking into the Israeli relationship to the Holocaust and the experience of Israelis who have gone on these trips to Auschwitz, these state-sponsored trips, I found a really fascinating poll which showed that Israeli veteran Israeli officers who had served in the West, who were basically leading units participating in the domination and control of Palestinians, and enforcing the occupation, who had been taken on these trips to Auschwitz, actually the trips had the opposite effect on them as they had on Israeli high schoolers who had not yet performed army duty. That their attitudes after the trip became extremely negative towards the state of Israel as a Jewish state. They became negative towards the army, and they were no longer nationalistic. And you have to ask, why did this have the opposite effect? Does it have something to do with participating in abuses against people who are confined behind a wall and are defined as an ethnic outclass? And did they see something that they had done in the exhibitions at Auschwitz? And I quote a soldier, a female soldier, from a Breaking the Silence testimony, who started to go through this period of reflection after she had just randomly abused a Palestinian bystander to impress the rest of her unit. You see this a lot from female Israeli soldiers, that they'll abuse Palestinian males to impress the males in their unit. And she started reflecting on the lessons of the Holocaust, but reflecting on them in the opposite way that Netanyahu does. She rejects the segregationist view of the Holocaust and starts to see it in a universalist perspective. Says, I was treating the Palestinian like Jews were treated in the past. And you see this throughout my book, Israelis reflecting on what's going on and seeing the darkest days of 1930s Germany. I mean, Eric Alterman in The Nation has attacked me for calling a chapter the concentration camp, for example. But the reason I call it, he doesn't attack the content of the chapter, which is about a detention facility for non-Jewish Africans in the desert that former speaker of the Israeli Knesset, Reuven Rivlin, has called a concentration camp and said, you know, as Jews, we shouldn't be doing that. Unfortunately, the logic of the Jewish state requires the maintenance of a demographic majority. And so when you have 60,000 non-Jews from Africa, you have to find a way of, quote-unquote, concentrating them and eventually removing them if you're to maintain that demographic majority. And so you have this crisis that's played out against the backdrop of the Holocaust for many Israelis, since they're educated in it for during the formative years of their lives.
Yeah, I want to talk about that aspect in a moment, because I think, you know, to a certain extent, there's a real, you know, particularly amongst American Jewry, or at least, that's where I feel, most comfortable sort of making this observation. There's a real generational divide there. And I want to get to that in a minute, but I want to talk a little bit more about what you saw, what you reported in terms of just getting a sense of what's happening with Israeli society. Because I think this dynamic, I mean, there's a real sense that I have that we can talk about whether or not this was sort of inevitable because of the logic of a Jewish state, but that there has been a mass exodus of Israelis who did not fall, for whom the logic that Bibi Netanyahu either believes and sort of promulgates did not take, essentially. This notion of being besieged was not enough for them to justify what was happening in that country. Can you give me a sense of to what extent you experienced that or noted that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a column in Haaretz right now by Neri Livni, who's talking about this phenomenon, because it's a major debate in Israel right now, why it's happening, why anywhere from 600,000 to 1 million Israelis are living abroad or spending much of their year abroad. And she said it's because...
And we should stop right there. People should understand that you're talking about 25, in terms of Israeli Jews, you're talking about what makes up 25% more of the population. I mean, that's massive.
First of all, we're talking about a very advanced society that's industrialized, that's a first world country. And the only other countries that have this percentage of their population living abroad are Sri Lanka and Mexico, which are two countries that have been destabilized by war and by civil war and the war on drugs. So that's about 14% of Israel, as Israelis can't stand living there most of their lives. So Neri Livni is one of the 15,000 to 20,000 young Israelis, or relatively young Israelis, who've moved to the city where the final solution was planned, Berlin, which is the destination of choice for young Israelis. And she said, I'm fleeing because Israel is a failure and a xenophobic theocracy. And her column is really strong and bracing. Most Israelis don't leave necessarily for that reason. Israeli Jews don't leave for those reasons. If they do, they don't necessarily pronounce it that way. They leave for economic reasons, because Israelis are also kind of gerbils in this neoliberal experiment, which has been carried out since the peace process began, because the peace process was also part of a process of globalization. And in order to open Israel up to foreign markets and lower tariffs and everything, there had to be some kind of normalization agreement with a putative Palestinian Authority. And so the Israeli standard of living has declined dramatically. The middle class has been shattered, just like in the United States, and they're looking for a way out. But then it's just a fact that if you're an Israeli, and this is something I noticed that, you know, really where I contrasted myself with many of the Israeli Jews I knew, was that I was able to travel even within their own land, in the land they controlled, much more widely than they were able to, because Israelis are actually legally banned from going to most Palestinian territory. And, you know, I've had friends interrogated with me for going into Ramallah. So they're in a way imprisoning themselves. Israel is almost completely surrounded by walls. The border of the Israeli-occupied Golan and Syria is completely mined. The entire 600 kilometers bordering the West Bank and going deep into the West Bank is surrounded by a separation wall, which Netanyahu said was put in place to prevent demographic spillover. Netanyahu's cut $360 million out of the social budget to build a wall along the Jordanian border. Then he has just built a wall along the border with the Sinai Peninsula to prevent non-Jewish Africans from entering. And the United States taxpayers have contributed $200 million, I think a year, to provide Israel with an iron dome that basically blankets its skies. And the Netanyahu advisor and Israeli demographer Arnon Sofer has actually called for sea walls to prevent climate change refugees from coming to Israel to preserve its Jewish character. So you're talking about really a hermetically sealed dystopia that the Israeli politician Tzipi Livni has actually called a fascist shtetl. So you can understand why a lot of people who reject Netanyahu's message of doom and gloom and constant exploitation of the Holocaust would want to go to a place like Berlin or like Los Angeles, because they really don't want this darkness anymore. And that's really, to me, what my book does is paint a picture of the Jewish state and of the Zionist movement in its terminal phase. Basically, everything that Herzl set out to do has been an absolute failure, and the situation has been reversed. So,
and that's
evidenced through this exodus.
And the nature of the exodus is such that that you can almost look at it as almost like a. Because I guess I got healthcare on my mind these days, but you can almost look at it as a sort of a an increased risk pool in terms of the people who are leaving. They are leaving behind the most fundamentalist, the most right wing, the most extreme, and they're being replaced to the extent that they're being replaced either by extreme elements from this country. Fundamentalist elements from this country, or in some respects, I guess that the wave of Russian emigres who brought with them a certain sort of weird, I don't know how to describe it, nationalism, fervent nationalism, has replaced them. I mean, so the sort of the psychographic of the Israeli population, it seems to me, over the past two decades, has dramatically changed. I mean, is that your sense from your reporting?
It's part of the permanent political transition that will shape Israeli society in the future, and that's a key theme in my book. So I'm really glad you brought it up. I mean, I see the 2009 elections as the culmination of a permanent political transition where the right wing has basically taken control from these sort of putatively moderate left-wing forces that used to stand behind the peace process and now really have backed away from it and accepted their marginal position. And one of the big reasons is the influx of Russians after post-Soviet Russia, after the fall of the Soviet Union. And this was all made possible or even necessary by the logic of the Jewish state. Again, this state needs to engineer its demographic majority over Palestinians, and so one of the best ways to do that is bring millions of new Jewish immigrants in. So they brought in at least 1 million Russians since the fall of the Soviet Union. Now many of them have been determined by state-appointed Israeli rabbis to not actually be Jews, and they feel sort of cheated. There's a lot of resentment against them, a lot of discrimination. But as you said, they have extremely authoritarian attitudes that they've brought over from the Soviet Union. Their attitudes towards Arabs is generally pretty bigoted. Many of them didn't even know Palestinians were going to be where they were. be well, a
this is the other thing.
It's
sort of a sort of you know, the I guess there's a certain amount of irony here, but it's sort of a 40 acres and a mule program for these guys, where they many of these Russian emigres end up living in new settlements in the West Bank. I mean, they're being used essentially as you know, as sort of these satellite outposts.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I write about a close friend of mine, Leah Tarachansky, whose family was brought over from the Soviet Union with the promise of lots of benefits and basically dumped in the mega settlement of Ariel. And I talk about her path from being raised on, you know, right-wing nationalism and, you know, anti-Palestinian, all these sort of anti-Palestinian attitudes, which were designed to sort of shape her Israeli identity, and then how she went away to college in Canada and saw this kind of multicultural society, met Palestinians on campus, and is now sort of an Israeli dissident, also one of the better journalists I know. And so she started trying to explore the roots of this crisis, her personal crisis and transformation, but also the crisis of Israeli society. And she found it, you know, in 1948 in the Nakba, or the Palestinian catastrophe. And so as she was filming a scene for her her documentary in her on her block in her settlement of Ariel, for the first time in her life she heard the call of the muezzin from the mosques and the Palestinian villages which actually surround her settlement, and it shook her so much that she had to cut the scene, because she realized that for her entire life she had never heard them, even though they were there all the time, and that she had been so heavily indoctrinated to negate the presence of Palestinians. This episode really shocked her, and I think there are a lot of young Russian Israelis who are kind of moving into dissident positions and starting to understand that they are facing discrimination, and so are Palestinians, because many of them have been judged to be not fully Jewish. But then you have the Yisro Betenu party, which is the second largest party in Israel right now, and its platform is no loyalty, no citizenship. In other words, if you can't demonstrate loyalty to the Jewish state, including through loyalty oaths, you should be stripped of your citizenship. And this is the party that Netanyahu relies on to hold power, along with Avigdor Lieberman, who is supposed to be foreign minister, but he has had to step down temporarily because of his intimate ties with the Russian mafia. And so his replacement, I mean, you think of Avigdor Lieberman as this big extremist who favors...
Well, but I don't know that people really understand who Avigdor Lieberman is. I mean, in American parlance, this guy would be, I don't know, I mean, maybe, you know, somewhere literally on the spectrum, like David Duke in his heyday. I mean, right? I mean, this guy is an unabashed, I guess maybe sort of like a even more rabid Pat Buchanan in his heyday.
He talks a similar line as Buchanan, but maybe more rabidly. But what I illustrate in my book is he's not that far outside the Israeli mainstream, although, right. You know, he's a former airport baggage handler from Moldova who used to walk around with bicycle chains on the campus of Hebrew University, intimidating Arab students, and that's where he gets his reputation from. But Lieberman's plan, this is again the leader of the second largest party in Israel, is to basically redraw the borders of Israel around these areas that are Palestinian areas. These are Palestinian citizens of Israel living in villages right along the Green Line, and he basically wants to redraw the border to strip them of their citizenship. He's not going to force them out of their homes. He's just going to unilaterally redraw the border and make them Palestinian Authority residents. And, you know, that puts him to the right of, you know, David Duke, who never proposed, you know, creating a new Africa in Louisiana, at least not when he was running for governor. But it also puts him in line with people like Tzipi Livni, who are marketed to the American public as kind of these peacemakers. And it's her who's in charge of the peace process. And you'll see her if you ever see any reporting on the peace process anymore, you'll see her on stage with Martin Indyk, who's Obama's negotiator, and you'll see her a lot in the American media. And she has proposed the same exact thing as Avigdor Lieberman. She was, when Bush was president, and this was during the Annapolis phase of the peace process, during negotiations with the Palestinians overseen by Condoleezza Rice, Tzipi Livni proposed redrawing the borders around Palestinian towns to strip tens of thousands of Palestinian citizens of Israel of their Israeli citizenship to increase the demographic majority of Jews in Israel. And so when this was revealed through the Palestine papers, these were leaked by Al Jazeera, these details, Avigdor Lieberman and his Yisrael Beiteinu party invited Tzipi Livni to a party meeting to celebrate her plan. And it was kind of a big joke in Israel, and she was incredibly embarrassed. But the point is that he is well within the mainstream, and if you look at polls of Israeli attitude, especially among young Israelis, if you look at the Israeli Democracy Institute polls, it shows that most young Israelis favor a strong leader like Lieberman and consider the Jewish character of Israel more important than its democratic charter. So this is just a perfect environment for someone like this. And I was going to point out that his replacement as foreign minister right now is another Russian named Zev Elkin, who is actually more right-wing than Lieberman. I interviewed him, and you can read about him in my book and my pretty remarkable interview with him. But he favors annexing most of the West Bank. Lieberman doesn't even favor that. So this is a guy who's emerging as the future of Likud. Netanyahu, it doesn't officially favor annexing the West Bank, but when that happens, apartheid comes out into the open, and there's no denying it anymore. This is really what the future of Likud and the future political leadership of Israel wants to do.
Let's talk a little bit about, the idea of the logic of the Jewish state, sort of. Is it fair to say that, in your mind, that there was an inevitability to this? I look at points, and we should say one of the other things that's really stunning about Israeli society that I think, you know, for me, paints is a snapshot that is one of the most disturbing, and I think also would be most shocking to, you know, because my sense is that liberal Jewry in this country, and I think this is a generational thing too, who grew up where support for Israel was so closely associated with their Jewish identity, I think has become largely sort of, if not ambivalent, apathetic, or if not apathetic, ambivalent about Israel because of this. But one of those things that sort of I think I find really discouraging is that nearly half of the country sees the assassin of Yitzhak Rabin as being a hero today.
Yeah.
I mean, this is stunning. And I think, this is part of the reason why I have been reluctant to talk about Israel, only because I don't see much hope there. And I think that, you know, in my mind, Israel is a country now that has hit that sort of point of death spiral, like, to, you know, in terms of an insurance pool, that it is now beyond, or at least it's got to get a lot worse there for it to ever get better, from a sort of a progressive humanitarian perspective. And I don't even know if that can happen, but it's fascinating to me. I mean, I'm curious from both the perspective of, you had a best-selling book about Republicans that I know that was widely widely praised and also widely touted. You're not going to get the same platform for this one, obviously. I'm curious both on your reception from just the mainstream media in general, but also from the Jewish community. I mean, I'm from a generation, not considerably older, but significantly older, where, you know, I grew up, and when I was in Hebrew school in as a 7-year-old, 8-year-old, they're showing us Night and Fog. And that was an intricate part of, and then it was about Israel. I mean, this was the way that you were taught. And when I was in second grade in Hebrew school, there was less time between then and the Holocaust than there is now, between that time now and when I was 7 years old. And so this dynamic is changing, and it seems like Israel is sort of like, and Netanyahu is sort of white-knuckled trying to push this formula for Jewish identity and legitimacy for Israel, and it's losing its grip in some way. And so in some ways, they have to tighten more.
Right. Well, if the question is about how I'm being received, especially by, you know, established Jewish media, I mean, first of all, you didn't have to have me on this program, and you've always been open to this discussion. I think you're one of the few people in the media who really is open to giving me a platform and talking about this subject honestly based on the facts on the ground. And, you know, that's pretty remarkable to me. I've basically been kind of boycotted so far by the Jewish establishment and by Jewish-oriented media. You know, and if they engage me at all, it will be sort of a drive-by attack, not to engage with my ideas, but, oh, well, we think we caught some little fact that you got wrong, so we're going to try to hit you with that. That's Jeffrey Goldberg's approach to me. He's blocked me on Twitter, but he'll happily do a drive-by shooting. But, you know, I'm trying to break through that boycott just by kind of circumventing it and forcing them to discuss these issues, which they don't want to acknowledge. And, you know, they're ignoring it at their own peril, because this does affect Jews in the United States. First of all, Israel's a project of the United States, and every American's responsible for it. So it's every American's responsibility to speak up for, not just about Israel, but about its victims and those who are living under Israeli control, who have been deprived the same rights that Americans enjoy simply because they are not of the right ethnicity. Now, you mentioned the sort of changing political dynamic, and I think when you look at what Israel's becoming, and you notice that it speaks on behalf of the quote-unquote Jewish people. Netanyahu, when he meets with, and I've personally witnessed this, when he meets with thousands and thousands of Christian, right-wing Christian evangelical end-timers, and they host them in Israel and Jerusalem at these stadium rallies, you know, calling for more settlements and not giving up one inch to the Palestinians, and he says to them, "We welcome you and the Jewish people love you." When Netanyahu is saying that the Jewish people, and Netanyahu has been introduced by David Gregory on American TV as the leader of the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. When he uses this language and they cultivate these kind of alliances with people who are operationally anti-Semitic, and they're cultivating alliances with neo-fascists in Europe, and meanwhile, you look at the Israeli municipal elections and you go to a city like Nazareth Elit, which is just above the mostly Arab town of Nazareth, and you note that the mayor has erected Israeli flags at the entrances of the town and declared this is a Jews-only town, we're banning Christmas trees and Christmas, we want Arabs out, and he's defining Judaism as a form of exclusivity and racism. You see this across the board in Israeli municipal elections. You have to be concerned that, especially as a secular Jew, that Israel could this continues, Israel is attempting to redefine what a Jew actually is. And that's something that I think should shock a lot of American Jews who are afraid to engage with this issue, is that they're changing the very image of Judaism and what it and redefining it into something that I don't think many of them could accept. And part of that redefinition is through this close and mounting alliance with Christian evangelicals who they're cultivating as the real future supporters in the United States of the Jewish state, who at their rallies are blowing shofars and right, wearing kippahs and wearing talit and dressing like Jews and doing Jewish folk dances, and who will tell me, swear to me when I interview them, that they are the real Jews. And being encouraged by the state of Israel to do this. So this is really, from a Jewish perspective, I think the heart of the crisis. And you have Jewish groups like Jewish Voice for Peace in the United States, which is just named one of the top 10 anti-Israel organizations by the Anti-Defamation League, this decrepit, bigoted organization, which opposed building a mosque in downtown New York. As you see them trying to reclaim Jewish identity from this Moloch that is defining it as something that is completely based around the control of another people, their domination and their exclusion, and really nothing else. So I think if you want me to put it in really stark terms, there it is, and that's what I see every time I go to Jerusalem.
And I think, you know, frankly, I think, you know, part of the reason why the, and particularly, you know, people of my age and older in particular, Jewish, otherwise, who perceive themselves as liberals and cannot see what is going on in Israel is because so much of that generation's Judaism was wrapped up in a vision of Israel, of an idea of Israel that, and I think there's an argument to be made as to whether or not it could have ever been something different, or if it was destined because of the way that it was born, and the logic of a Jewish state, whether or not there was a certain inevitability to this. But at that time, it was certainly not, you know, clear, and there was still, you know, you were still closer to the Holocaust, which sort of overran things. And so in some ways, you know, this part of the reason why I think it is so taboo to acknowledge the reality of what's going on in Israel within the otherwise liberal Jewish population of this country. And just statistically, the Jewish population is more to the left than I think than, you know, any sort of than most ethnicities, is because of this idea that their Jewish identity is so tied to an Israel that really doesn't exist anymore. It may never have existed, but it's certainly the potential of that Israel no longer exists.
Yeah, and it's all about potential. Israel has never been a democracy. It's always stripped millions of Palestinians of their rights while controlling them. Even beginning in 1948, it placed them under military rule, even as they were citizens. So the idea was that there was the potential that Israel could become a democracy through some kind of solution, through some kind of negotiated solution with the Palestinians. That's not going to happen. It is just not going to happen. The former director of the Shin Bet, Israel's General Security Service, Yuval Diskin, 2 days ago, basically declared in an op-ed that there is not going to be a two-state solution, and he's deeply troubled about what will come next. And so I think it's really up to all of us to start envisioning a different kind of future and get past this bloody impasse. And my book doesn't really propose a one-state solution or a two-state solution, but it gives people an idea of the implications of maintaining the status quo.
Right.
And, you know, from the perspective of Jewish identity, which you brought up, Sam, you know, it's very hard to envision something beyond the Jewish state, even if you can't fully accept the implications of what a Jewish state means. Because for a lot of young American Jews, and the recent Pew polls show this, that young American Jews are less religious than ever. So what do you rally around as Jews? How do you find a communal identity? I mean, one of the easiest things to rally around is the state of Israel.
Right.
If the birthright Israel trip taking hundreds of thousands of American Jews, I mean, a sizable percentage of the young American Jewish community on free trips to Israel, and they take them to the Western Wall, which is sort of the remnant of the Second Temple, the Roman era Second Temple. And you go to this big plaza, this is like the culmination of the trip. And I remember all the guys on my trip are crying and saying, I wish, because I went on this tour, I wish my father could have seen me. And you see grown men in hotels around Jerusalem crying all night because they went to this wall and they worshiped these rocks, this gender-segregated wall, by the way.
Yes.
And you look at the wall from a distance and you see the three poles of Jewish identity are right there. It's all being done. There's the wall. There's the kind of religious pole and ancestor worship. Then you have the candelabra marking the 6 million killed in the Holocaust. And then you have the flag of the state of Israel. Young American Jews are kind of growing distant from the Holocaust. It's not part of their reality anymore, and they're living in a golden age in the U.S. They're not religious, so not that into this kind of you know, doing mitzvot and worshiping all the time. And then there's just the Israeli flag that's there, but I want them to understand that there is a fourth pole that lays beneath that plaza, and that that plaza used to be the Moroccan quarter. It used to be a Palestinian neighborhood. Jews had always, until before this, the creation of the State of Israel, Jews were able to worship there. That thousands of Palestinians were living there, and as soon as the State of Israel conquered this area, and there's this iconic image of them at the wall, these soldiers that many, you know, many people, you know, have posters of this image. But as soon as they conquered this area, they ethnically cleansed the Moroccan quarter. They bulldozed every home in order to build the plaza to increase the capacity for tourism, especially Jewish tourism at the base of the plaza. And those Palestinians were put in a refugee camp, which is now surrounded by fences and walls, called Shufat, which is within the Jerusalem municipality, but they can't receive the same benefits and services as Jewish Israelis, even though they pay taxes, and they're not citizens, they're residents of Jordan, so they're officially discriminated against. So I want them to know that there's this fourth pole of ethnic cleansing that's been injected into Jewish life through this occupying Jewish state, and it's something that they have to grapple with, along with these other three poles. And so that's, you know, if you want to look at this book, which is just really straight journalism and analysis from the perspective of Jewish identity, I think that's what I'm aiming to accomplish.
Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, thanks so much for your time today, and congratulations on the book.
Thanks so much, Sam.
All right, folks, let's head into the second half of the program. The number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me. Folks, Credo Mobile is a sponsor of this program. We've talked about them quite a bit through Credo Action. They support progressive causes. They fight teabag Republicans. They are willing to fight conservative Democrats as well. They fight to protect Social Security. They also have donated millions of dollars to progressive nonprofits. They're the biggest donator to Planned Parenthood last year, I believe it was. 1% of all their revenue goes there. They have a deal for listeners this month. You go to credomobile.com/Sam. You can get the link on majority.fm. You get up to $350 credit to switch over to their service. Applied to your change fee if your current provider forces, you know, has one on you. And then you get 25% discount on data for 2 years. It's unlimited data. Check it out today. The offer exists for only 9 more days. So go to credomobile.com/Sam and support that sponsor, and also support progressive political action. You can also support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. You know the details. You can also, if you buy Amazon crap, buy it through our Amazon link. You can find that at majority.fm. You bookmark it. You always buy through there. We get a kickback. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Tomorrow on the program, Mark Leibovich on his book, Our Town. Don't forget... give us a review on iTunes or our app. You can get the app at majorityapp.com. Coming up in the better half, there's a plan afoot to sue gayness.
One man. One thing.
If you want to call in, talk about that interview with Max Blumenthal, number 646-257-3920. Obviously, very controversial. And there's frankly not many places you're going to hear an interview that of that length with Mac Blumenthal or anywhere, I think. You know, for some of the reasons that we talked about in the interview. So call in. Let's talk about it. I still got a lot more to say, but I wanted to let Max do most of the talking, obviously. I have my own thoughts on the situation. And frankly, you know, to be honest, I find it very depressing. But let's do it. 646-257-3920. If you're watching on YouTube, call in. If you're listening to live on the stream, call in. We'll be back in just a moment.